This is the Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of September the 19th, 2016. Current Federal Tax Developments are brought to you by Nichols Patrick CP Incorporated and your state society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, and I'm taking a look at what's gone on this week in the area of federal taxes. And this week, we're going to have a few things happening. We're going to take a look at a couple of issues here. First, we're going to take a look at a minister who decided that his vow of poverty should allow him to escape taxes, and we'll discover that does work in some limited cases, but not in the case this particular minister was looking for. We're also going to take a look at a question of what's alimony. This will be a payment to a former spouse, fairly significant payment, but we're going to take a look at whether that payment truly was or was not alimony. We're going to take a look at the issue in another case about whether the income should properly have been taxable and deductions properly taken by a corporation or the corporation's shareholders. We'll also then take a look at an organization that was denied tax-exempt 501c3 status because of private inurement. And finally, we're going to take a look at what exactly could qualify for reasonable cause for late filing of a tax return. So we're going to take a look at a lot of those issues here today. So we're going to get ourselves here up and running. Let's go ahead and take a look. One thing that is happening, this is we're now past the September 15th due date for corporate partnerships, et cetera. The last time we're going to pass that date for some of the, because trust will be moving next year to September 30th. What we need is another date that we have to be racing towards again next year. But this year we only have the one. So I'm going to be doing a lot of events here on the road. And I'm going to be in, actually starting out this week in Sioux City, Iowa, actually across the river in the Nebraska, just across the river in Nebraska, but I'm going to be doing it for the Iowa Society of CPAs. So I'll be off there this week, but then coming up afterwards, and I'll go to North Dakota, as I mentioned last week, to do their conference. But following that, I've got a series of events coming up here shortly in the state of Idaho. So I thought I'd tell you about all of them here as one that we've got here coming up in September and October. And September 29th and 30th in Boise, I'll be doing a section on fringe benefits. And then following that on the 30th, I'll be doing partnership taxation advanced issues. Then following the October 15th deadline, I'm going to be doing a tour around the northern part in the west. And I'll be in Lewiston, Idaho on October 24th and 25th. I'll be doing an update on individual tax topics on the 24th, update on business tax topics on the 25th. And then on October 31st and November 1st, I'll repeat that same pair, this time in Twin Falls, Idaho. So if you're going to be looking for any of those courses, you're going to be in those areas, be sure to consider signing up for those courses and consider, you know, it's beginning at that time of year, we're looking at updates and all the other fun stuff in taxes. So now's the time to consider getting yourself ready for your new CPE requirements for this year. So with that, let's go ahead and take a look at our first development for this week. This is the case of White versus Commissioner. This is case Tax Credit Memorandum Decision 2016-167. The case came down on September the 12th. This particular individual, now, you know, sometimes you think, wait, vow of poverty, individual just says I'm not subject to tax. You start thinking about, oh, maybe this is one of those, you know, kind of, shall we say, the tax protesters. I realize the IRS can't call them that anymore, but we all kind of know what that category is. No, this is actually a gentleman who truly was a minister, and he had been a minister for quite a while. But he apparently discovered that there was this issue about ministers who've taken vows of poverty do not have to pay income taxes on the amounts that are paid for them for living expenses. So he decided that, well, he would go ahead and take the vow of poverty, and his church went ahead and recognized that. And he said, well, I should be able to escape taxes. Now, one of the problems he had was he based his particular view of this on a 1919 IRS ruling. That particular 1919 IRS ruling, and this is OD-119, if you want to go look it up, if you can find something that will give it to you that well, told us a clergyman is not liable for any income tax on amounts received by him during the year from the parish of which he is in charge, provided he turns over to the religious order of which he is a member all money received in excess of his actual living expenses on account of the vow of poverty that he has taken. Well, he said in this case, he basically did. He had all the funds he received was deposited into an account. Now, he was the only person who had the right to sign off on that account, which was an interesting problem. He used that to pay personal expenses. The tax court said the only problem with that, sir, is that the IRS has actually updated this ruling, and Revenue Ruling 77-290 essentially says that effectively you have to turn the money over and lose control to the religious order, something he was not doing. So the court said, look, guy, despite what you read, and we realize, you know, you read the old ruling, rulings do get updated and superseded, and you might worry about that with the 1919 ruling. Secondly, though, the court said, you really didn't give up sufficient control. We're not going to simply say that all you had to do was like a journal entry, shall we say, to transfer these funds over, and then you still had them in your bank account. You still could basically do what you wanted with them. We're not going to actually let you go ahead and make that and treat that as if you had no income. Rather, we're going to treat that as income. If you do have the situation with vow of poverty, you need to take a look at the 1977 ruling described in the material we have on the current federal tax developments.com website, which will tell you about what you need to do and what cases would work. But generally, just a vow of poverty and then letting the minister have control over a bank account, probably not going to work. We'll just phrase it that way. Next up, we have the case of Leslie versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2016-171. This one was decided on September 14th. Now, this was a case, interestingly enough, she was divorcing an attorney. This attorney was involved in litigation that involved Enron, and he was representing an investor class. And so there was a fairly significant dollar amounts involved. It was somewhat, at the time of their divorce, it wasn't clear what was going to happen. But shortly after that, a rather large award was given. And in fact, her total amount that she's going to receive ended up being well over $5 million. So she got 10% of the contingent legal fees in her divorce. Now, even though that section in her divorce put that in the property settlement section of the decree, the document she signed said that the intent of the parties was to treat this as spousal maintenance, and it would be taxable to her, and it would also be deductible to him. Now, of course, the interesting aside is that the test for alimony is a federal tax law test. There are four tests. Those four tests said the payment has to be received by or on behalf of a spouse under divorce or separation agreement. That clearly is covered in this case. The second case is the divorce or separation agreement does not say it will not be alimony. Well, you know, it doesn't say you can make it alimony, but we can make it not, but it clearly didn't do that with what it said. They have to live in separate households. That wasn't a problem here. So the fourth category to make it alimony is simply the question of would the payment cease on the death of the recipient spouse. As often is the case, unfortunately, these cases, you know, the agreement doesn't actually say what would happen. But the tax court went back and said, well, what would state law do? And in this case, they determined it was California provides that spousal maintenance is not payable after the death of the recipient spouse unless there was an explicit agreement to the contrary. Because there was no explicit agreement, it didn't matter. The court also said it didn't matter that you thought this was a property settlement, and that's in the property settlement section. The inquiry into what your purpose was really isn't relevant. The only inquiry is whether you meet the four criteria and you're not blocked by any of the other rules. And in this case, it was not disguised child support, nor did it end up being something that would appear to be, you know, that would have to have alimony recapture. At least initially, it wouldn't be anyway. So the bottom line was that she had to pay tax on this as alimony. It's taxable alimony to her. There's no option to get around that. Remember, the key issue here is federal law, as always, treats alimony under that four-factor test. If the alimony doesn't qualify, if the alimony qualifies under the four-factor test, it is. And if it doesn't, it's not. The key danger, again, if you are the person paying the alimony who wants a deduction, normally the problem comes down to that is it payable after the death of the recipient spouse. If the agreement's silent, then we have to worry about state law. Flip side of that is if you don't want it to be taxable, well, that's an easy fix. All you have to do there is have as part of the agreement a statement that it won't be. In this case, that statement wasn't there. And as well, the court found that state law would have made it not payable to her after her death. They're payable to her estate. Actually, she wouldn't get anything, obviously, after her death. But since it wasn't payable after her death, therefore, there is no, you know, therefore, it's treated as alimony and she has to pick that up as income. Next up, we have a problem with taxpayers who set up a corporation but then didn't want to treat that as the recipient of income. This is the case of the Barnhart Ranch Company et al. Versus Commissioner, Tax Code Memorandum Decision 2016-170, issued on September 14th. Now, the one interesting aside in this case, you got to watch the title of it. There are a whole group of taxpayers involved in this. And the corporation we're going to talk about here is not Barnhart Ranch Company, but this corporation called BRC. Now, BRC was formed by these individuals. And BRC, essentially, that was a cattle. Basically, they raised cattle, they sold cattle. BRC was listed as the owner of the cattle whenever they sold it. BRC had all the employees of the cattle operation, and BRC had the insurance. But the taxpayers and their father for years had been reporting the cattle operation on their 1040s and had been reporting very little or virtually nothing on BRC. In fact, it actually survived a couple of exams where this issue was never raised, that their father had survived them. But in this case, the IRS said, wait, everything here appears to be BRC, which by the way is a C corporation. That's who should be taxable. And why that's important is because the cattle operation generated very significant losses. The taxpayer said, no, this is merely an accounting entity. It merely does accounting for us, or it's an agency with us. Well, the court said, A, they didn't buy the accounting argument because they said there was no evidence the company provided accounting services to anyone. In fact, they said it actually paid for accounting services. Secondly, they said the agency, there was no evidence in this case that they were acting as pure, that the corporation acted as a pure agent. They noted that they, you know, third parties were never told that the corporation didn't really own the cattle. They did all their contracts in the name of the corporation. They effectively, you know, never really made clear to anybody else that it was anything but the corporation doing this. And because of that, they couldn't ignore the corporation. Now, the taxpayers then came back and said, well, I mean, obviously, we could have made an S election. There could have been no real difference in treatment. And the court said very simply, well, could have isn't what you did. And you have to live with what you did. This is one of those cases that illustrates a point we've discussed before. It's very difficult for a taxpayer who is in charge of the form of a transaction to try to argue substance over form, which is kind of what they're trying to argue here. That we really were the owners and it wasn't really, you know, we don't care what the form is. We really are the owners of these cattle. The problem is they set up the corporation. They didn't take care to make sure everything was tied on their personal name. Because of that, their losses are now sitting inside that corporation. They have a nice big net operating loss care of in the corporation, but they owe a whole bunch of tax at the individual level. And that's because, unfortunately, they didn't take care to make sure that they were actually treating things and recording things the way they should have had that truly been the corporation not been the owner of this of these items, and they actually been selling them personally. Next up, a private letter ruling. Private letter ruling 2016-37017, issued on September the 9th, 2016. This is a denial by the IRS of an organization's attempt to be treated as a not-for-profit 501c3 organization. Now, at least initially, this sounds like a good, you know, charitable organization. The organization was created to assist adolescent children and their families in coping with various diagnosed and undiagnosed diseases. I mean, that sounds like a perfectly good charitable, reason to form an organization. Sounds like would be a very upstanding and good concept. But here's the problem. First thing is they did wait a few years to apply for this, and that gave the IRS a track record to look at. Secondly, the issue was all of the benefits had been paid out to the son of the founder, who, by the way, yes, had a significant disease and was in his adolescence, and all those funds went there. The court, you know, the IRS said, look, despite the fact this may be a charitable idea, this child very well could be, you know, somebody who would be the proper party to be receiving charitable assistance from a charity. It certainly would be in line, you know, assisting somebody with this sort of a problem. But the hitch is you were the only one being assisted and it was being set up for this particular private person. A charity cannot, if you violate the private inurement rules, you no longer have a charitable organization. It doesn't matter if who you're benefiting is somebody that would be a reasonable recipient of charity. You have to ignore the private inurement rules. You had to be, sort of had to have a public benefit. This did not have a public, but a private benefit. For that reason, the organization was denied tax-exempt status and is stuck with essentially what we have in this case. They're not going to get their exemption. And obviously, it's going to have to pay tax as a corporation. And the deductions, no deductions will be allowed for any contributions to this organization. Now, next up, we have a case, and this is our final case for this week. And this one is an interesting discussion. This is actually a chief counsel advice, 2016-37012. This was issued on September the 9th of 2016. This is an interesting case because in this case, we have a taxpayer who was clearly suffering from dementia. Now, the taxpayer had given a durable power of attorney to a third party. But because the taxpayer was unable to effectively keep up with, you know, her life and, you know, keep everything straight, she had failed to file a tax return for the year in question and had also failed to pay the tax. So when she finally got around, they finally got around to filing the return, she was liable for both failure to pay and failure to file penalties. The question being raised in this chief counsel advice, obviously the taxpayer is asking for relief from the penalties. The question is, should it be granted and under what theory? The IRS agent who's asking the question in the national office said, well, they see two potential theories. First, obviously she has dementia. And, you know, is dementia a reasonable cause for being unable to file your return or for late filing return? They said, and then the second theory was, since there was this individual with a power of attorney who apparently had the power to make sure that she took action she should have, like getting this return filed, and that power of attorney holder failed to take action. Well, is that reasonable cause? You know, the fact that the POA holder failed to notice this problem and take action on it, is that reasonable cause for the late filing penalty? And the national office said, you know, we think you should analyze this a couple of ways. The interesting first step was they said, what you really should do, if it's possible, is take advantage of the first-time abatement rule. You look at our written materials. We have the description there of what's in the Internal Revenue Manual in the Penalties Handbook section. There is a concept called first-time abatement. It applies generally if a taxpayer has not been subject to one of the covered penalties in the prior 3 years and they filed the returns. It covers the failure to file, failure to pay, you know, failure to file, failure to pay, and failure to deposit penalties. So any one of those could be covered by FTA. Administratively, the Internal Revenue Manual provides that if you meet the requirements, so you've not violated the rules in the past, and everything seems to be working fine for you in this regard, so we haven't violated the rules, and now we suddenly have a problem because we filed one return late, the IRS will grant you first-time abatement. And this is something that all practitioners should be aware of, because it's important to remind an agent on the phone, if you have the ability to use FTA, to make sure that you point them to the section of the Internal Revenue Manual and get the use of FTA if you believe that's what's appropriate to be used in this standpoint. Now, as some will point out, the danger here is once you burn your FTA, that's going to count against you. So for 3 more years, you can't get it again. But sometimes it's the only option you've got. And as this memo makes clear, the IRS wants to use that if at all possible so that there's been a burned session. But they went on and said if for some reason the taxpayer is not eligible for first-time abatement, dementia could be a reasonable cause. The memo says, obviously, this is a factual matter. You'll need to develop the facts of the case and see if her dementia really prevented her from timely filing a return. But it seems likely that they'll be able to cover that would be a reasonable cause exception. They said that definitely can be if her dementia was serious enough. Finally, they took a look at the power of attorney theory. And there the IRS National Office drew the line. Nobody can basically push off their filing requirements on a third party, be that a power of attorney holder or be that somebody who maybe is, you know, like a CPA that failed to file your extension when you thought they were going to. That sort of failure is one that's never delegatable. You've got to make sure you file on time. You're supposed to understand you have a filing responsibility. They said, in this case, if her dementia didn't cause her personally to be unable to file the return, then you're not going to get out with the POA holder. And it makes some sense. If she was able to take care of it, then there's no excuse for it not be taken care of. If she's not able to, then we have a different problem. So interesting case, an interesting discussion of how you analyze getting out of penalties. Well, it's that time of year again. We're getting here to the end of the year. And, you know, before you know it, the post-October 15th dates will be here. And that's the time I know most of you just love to get your continuing education. So it's really time to get learning and think about registering with your state society for these upcoming courses. The state society catalogs have tons of courses on a bunch of topics. You can check out your topics on taxes, on accounting, on all kinds of technology. There are issues that cover everything. Be sure to check that as a source of really good live interactive coursework. Make sure you take a look, see what's there, plan out the rest of the year, and don't let yourself be caught, you know, napping where you don't get your where you don't really get the information you need in time to be able to service your clients here as we're heading up to the end of the year and getting ready for our planning standpoint. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of September the 19th. As always, you can catch our daily updates on the website, currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also download from there a PDF file with articles on all of today's topics on the weekly updates page. So you can move there and find this. You can basically read about all of these. You can also, as I say, during the week, we're going to post our updates as we write them so you can read about new developments as they go along. Be sure to check your State Society of CPAs websites for all the full-day continuing education programs that we here at Nichols Patrick are offering, as well as those offered by all the other vendors that your State Society deals with. If you have any questions or comments about this week's information, you can send them to me at edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at edzollers. I will post updates there as things happen. And you can be sure to go ahead and join us next week when we'll take a look at the new developments that occur in the area of federal taxes.